this is for. And it is also lesson four in our course. In the previous lesson, we considered the contribution that the Bible makes to the counseling process, and we came to that conclusion by examining the Bible itself. There we noted that the Bible provides the foundational truth for all fields of inquiry, and for some fields, such as psychology, that reside close to the heartland of biblical concerns, we concluded that the Bible plays an even larger role, supplying not only the foundation of our counseling house, but also the superstructure, leaving only the sheetrock and the furnishings to be supplied by psychology. In this lesson, we'll begin to consider the same topic, that is, the rightful role of psychology in the counseling process, only now by examining the nature of psychology. Instead of looking at the Bible this time, we look at psychology to see what we can learn about the role of psychology in the counseling process. In this lesson, we will address this issue by analyzing psychology from a macroscopic perspective, examining its general impact on society as a whole, and then reasons for that impact. In other words, in this lesson, we're not going to look at psychology in detail, but we're going to look at its overall general impact, its overall general success. First, let's look at the rationale for using psychology in counseling. At least we're going to consider the rationale that's frequently given. It is asserted that evangelicals should use psychology in the counseling process because it is scientific. This assertion is most frequently framed in the cliche, all truth is God's truth. This expression is telling us that God has given human beings two primary means of discovering truth, revelation and empiricism. And by empiricism, we're talking about the use of observation and reason to determine the nature of reality. We look out there, we glean observations, and as we study the observations that we have recorded, we develop hypotheses, and then we seek to substantiate those hypotheses. The empirical approach finds its most formal expression in what's called the scientific method. Both epistemologies, that is, both revelation and empiricism, are God-given, at least I believe so, and we'll talk about that in a minute. They're both God-given, and they both work effectively when used properly, that is, with diligence and accuracy and within the realm for which they were designed. Therefore, it is legitimate and even necessary to use both epistemologies in the formulation of our worldview. This assertion that all truth is God's truth, understood as described above, seems to me to be undeniable. I've heard some people contest this concept on the basis of our inability to make conclusive findings by means of the scientific method. The argument goes that since we cannot trust our empirical skills, we can only have confidence in the pronouncement of Scripture. There are two flaws with this argument. The first is that our exegetical skills are not foolproof either. In other words, if we're saying that, well, we're going to reject science, we're going to reject empiricism because so many of the findings turn out to be challenged, well, a lot of theological findings are not conclusive either. We have the Baptist saying one thing and Presbyterian saying another and so forth and so on. So that argument, if we apply it to Scripture, we'd have to reject Scripture too, consider the many different theological positions on a given issue. A second rebuttal is that science has demonstrated its capacity to make valid findings when it works within the realm that God designed it to work. We will consider the accomplishments of science as we go along in this lesson. In other words, to reject the empiricism, we have to reject so many science findings of science that seem to be effective, that seem to be helpful. There's a lot of support for the effectiveness of science, and science, to a great extent, is empiricism. Therefore, I believe that the assertion, all truth is God's truth, is a valid one, and that most evangelicals would agree. As we utilize input from both sources appropriately, we can be assured that revelation and empiricism will always be in agreement. As one psychologist stated the case, quote, I have found that carefully produced scientific data and the Christian worldview are complementary. There is no contradiction between good science and good theology. And that's found in the book Psychology and Christianity, page 87. Therefore, just as the laws of science relating to gravity, electricity, medical advances, etc., are all a legitimate part of a biblical worldview, likewise, the valid findings of psychology, the scientific empirical findings of psychology, can and should also be included as an aspect of the truth that encompasses our worldview. If we believe that all truth is God's truth, if we find psychological truth, then certainly there's every reason in the world why we should incorporate that into our worldview, into our approach to life, including into the counseling process. By adopting the assertion that all truth is God's truth, it seems that we are validating the findings of psychology, and thus asserting that psychological concepts in general should be incorporated into our approach to counseling. However, the matter is not quite that easy. As we noted earlier, acceptance of psychology is predicated on psychology being science. Though we believe that all truth is God's truth, we have not yet established that all psychology is scientific and therefore constitutes empirical truth. This is the issue that we will be examining in this chapter. We begin by noting that a substantial body of evidence supports the conclusion that science provides an effective means of discovering truth. It is apparent that scientific research has brought us many blessings, from good medicine, medical care, to comfortable homes and travel. Perhaps the most dramatic expression of scientific accomplishment was putting a man on the moon, though the mapping of the DNA molecule may be an even more astounding feat. These accomplishments and countless others confirm the credibility of scientific research if, in our society, that credibility needs to be confirmed. Most people in our society see science and equate science with truth. They believe that science works and produces credible results. However, those advances, the ones that we mentioned above, the DNA molecule, putting a person on the moon, and so forth, represent achievements in natural sciences, achievements in the social sciences and various disciplines related to the behavior of human beings, including psychology, comprise quite another matter. While there is substantial evidence that humanity has been making strides forward in the area of the natural sciences, the evidence that we have been losing ground in our understanding of the human being is equally as compelling. In other words, just as there's a tremendous amount of evidence that we are doing well in the natural sciences and discovering a lot of truths, there's not a whole lot of evidence that we're really learning in the social sciences, that we're really learning more about people. If anything, it appears that we have more error now than we've ever had before. Just today, another school shooting took place, this one involving a 15-year-old boy in California who killed two of his classmates and wounded 13 others. As you know, this is not an isolated incident, but rather part of an ongoing trend in our society. This type of incident is just one of the many categories of evidence that points to societal decline. These sorts of tragedies were unheard of in our society in recent history until a fairly short time ago. Therefore, having these types of incidences now and having so many of them clearly shows a decline in our understanding of people, or at least our capacity to help people to live better. Many sources document the societal decline statistically, such as William Bennett's Index of Cultural Indicators, the rise in the divorce rate, the use of drugs, births out of wedlock, cohabitation of unwed couples, educational decline, increases in suicide, and many other symptoms all indicate that whatever discoveries have been made related to human behavior, their impact does not validate the effectiveness of theories propounded in these areas, but rather shows them to be counterproductive. It should be noted that these individual and societal problems do not just reflect the decline from a Christian perspective. But even those maintaining a secular orientation would agree that trends such as educational decline and increase in suicide are not good. In other words, some may say, well, there's decline from the perspective of you Christians, but really from the perspective of us secular people, things are really going a lot better. Cohabiting is really a step forward. Birth out of wedlock may not be all that bad. However, the truth of the matter is, even from a secular perspective, many of the trends today are not good. We are moving, even from a secular perspective, in the wrong direction. For the purpose of our study, it is significant that most of the areas of decline are areas under the influence of psychology. We have seen that psychology predominantly deals with human behavior, emotions, and relationships. It is specifically in these areas that our society is experiencing the greatest devastation. For example, there's little question that in our society, psychology provides the predominant input in the area of marriage and family. Even in evangelical circles, we draw heavily on psychology to glean insights on family relations. Barbara Defoe Whitehead, in her book, The Divorce Culture, in considering trends in our culture related to marriage, observes that, quote, even pastoral marriage counseling began to acquire a more psychotherapeutic organization, end quote. She then quotes from the book, Unfaithful Angels, how social work has abandoned its mission, and that book is by Harry Specht and Mark Courtney. And these authors say, quote, ministers and priests have come to look and act more and more like psychotherapists, just as psychotherapists have come to look and act more and more like priests, end of quote. In other words, pastors and priests and counseling, rather than drawing from the Bible, are drawing from psychology. And when she says that psychotherapists are looking more like priests, she's saying what we've already said in lesson one, and that is that psychology in our society really takes on a religious overtone. Barbara Defoe Whitehead goes on to observe, quote, pastoral counseling began to take a client-centered approach that required clergy to stay within the client's value system. Pastors and congregations retreated from theological challenge to an individual's values on the psychotherapeutic ground that such a challenge would be damaging to the individual's selfhood and would come across as preachy and moralistic. In other words, Whitehead is saying that rather than counseling a person from the biblical perspective, pastors and priests started counseling people using psychology and a client-centered approach that would accept them as they were, and not try to impose biblical values on them, because they didn't want to scar their psyches, hurt their egos, nor did they want to come across preachy. Whitehead continues, quote, perhaps more surprisingly, psychology made inroads into the evangelical denomination. Unlike the mainliners, evangelicals tended to use psychology to support traditional religious teaching on marriage and family, although over time they too came to view marital dissolution in more psychological terms. In other words, originally psychology was used as that which was compatible with the biblical perspective, but over time psychology got the upper hand. Our point here is that psychology has played the predominant role in guiding marriage in our society, even in religious, including evangelical circles. Therefore, this failure in the area of marriage in our society must be considered in our evaluation of the effectiveness of psychology. Since psychology has been the predominant force, since marriage seems to be a failing institution, psychology must bear the responsibility for that. Psychology has also exercised a commanding role over our society's approach to parenting. In his book, A Family of Value, by psychologist John Rosemond, he describes how psychology gained influence over the child-rearing process in our society. Its ineffectiveness, Rosemond talks about the ineffectiveness of psychology in teaching on child rearing, and how ultimately he came to reject psychological concepts that he had learned when he went to school to study psychology. Again, Rosemond is underscoring both the influence and the failure of psychology in this arena of child rearing. We find the same process at work in the field of education. Maureen Stout has described this phenomenon in her book, The Feel-Good Curriculum, The Dumbing Down of America's Kids in the Name of Self-Esteem. Her book makes essentially the same point that we have observed in these other areas, namely that psychology has had a vast influence and that that vast influence has produced negative results. And the same might be said of the influence and the negative impact of psychology in many other areas as well. Therefore, we must conclude that the contributions of psychology viewed from the more macroscopic perspective have been counterproductive. That is not to suggest that every contribution made by psychology is flawed. However, it does appear that whenever psychology provides the commanding theoretical position, the core concepts, the guiding principles in a given area, that area experiences decline. Therefore, though some may argue for accepting psychology as science, it is wise to be guided by the old cliché that tells us that the proof of the pudding is in the taste. After all the arguments have been advanced, the success or failure of a theory must be determined by the bottom line. And while the bottom line for the natural sciences has been highly favorable, the bottom line for psychology across the past number of decades shows a serious deficit balance. Therefore, we must be cautious in labeling the findings of psychology as truth. This distinction between the success of the natural sciences and the failure of the disciplines related to human behavioral emotions and relations, and especially psychology, is an important distinction for our study, because those in the latter category, in other words, psychologists, tend to ride the coattails of the natural sciences in establishing their credibility. That is, those seeking to establish the scientific credibility of psychology tend to point to the successes of natural sciences as a confirmation of their own legitimacy. They construct the equation, science is successful, and to prove that, they look at all the natural sciences, the man on the moon, the DNA molecule, and so forth. And then they continue the equation by saying, psychology is science, therefore psychology must be successful, psychology must be truth. This line of reasoning has convinced many in the general public, I should say most in the general public, and even many, if not most, evangelicals, that psychology is scientific and psychology represents truth. And if we say all truth is God's truth, we must include psychology. We see, however, that there is a good reason not to lump psychology in with the natural sciences as a source of truth, not to see psychology along with physics and chemistry and the natural sciences. And there's reason to believe that equation that we just mentioned is fallacious. Rather, scientific credibility of psychology is in serious question. As we look at its ineffectiveness, as we look at its failure, as we look at the contrast in its success as opposed to the natural sciences, we have to put a big question mark over the validity, over the scientific nature of psychology. This conclusion leads us to the question, why is that? Why has psychology failed so miserably? What are the challenges that face psychology in discovering truth that prevent it from doing a better job? Or to state the question differently, what are the possible reasons for the ineffectiveness of psychology in its attempt to develop theoretical constructs for understanding and guiding human behavior? Psychology may be ineffective, especially in the development of major theoretical structures, because work with humans presents the researcher with an overwhelming number of variables. For example, in the study of anger, the researcher would need to consider genetic factors, physiological factors such as potential brain injuries, health, and diet, the past nurturing of the subject, the person's present situation, including various relationships and stresses. He'd have to think about his lifestyle and thought patterns, the individual's spiritual life, and many other factors. Within each of these categories exist virtually thousands of, if not millions, of potential variables. In a scientific study, the task of the researcher is to isolate variables so that he can study the influence of one variable on another. In the study of human personality, the overwhelming number of variables makes this task extremely difficult, if not impossible. The researcher may use control groups and other methods in an attempt to overcome these complexities, yet the task is daunting. And the challenge becomes heightened as the researcher seeks to broaden the scope of inquiry. For example, a study determining the correlation between blood pressure and anger would seem to be a relatively easy experiment. However, even a simple experiment such as this would include serious challenges. For example, the researcher would need to establish some criterion or criteria to determine levels of anger, such as providing the subject with a scale of 1 to 5 and defining symptoms at each level. In other words, a level 1 anger would be characterized by certain symptoms and a level 2 by other symptoms and so forth. It can be seen that such an approach is quite subjective, and that presents a problem for researchers. There's also the challenge of determining what impact being involved in an experiment has on the subject's blood pressure. In other words, just being in an experiment would impact the person's blood pressure. In the doctor's office, they call this a white coat syndrome, where for many people, the blood pressure goes up just because they're in the doctor's office. The real challenge in this type of experiment is filtering out factors that are affecting blood pressure other than anger. For example, it would be interesting to determine if the results might be affected by gender issues. For example, if the subject were a male, it would be interesting to determine if having a female taking the blood pressure would produce different results than having a male perform this test. Or even the age, appearance, and personality of the person taking the blood pressure might be a factor. Also, time of day, temperature of the room, the atmosphere within the room, lighting, time since the subject's last meal and what he ate, number of other people in the room, comfort of the chair on which the person is seated, and many other factors could influence the results. A good researcher will seek to standardize as many factors as he can. However, as we can see, it is virtually impossible to take every factor into account. No doubt the person's health, what he is thinking about at the moment, previous bad experiences with experiments, and a multitude of other variables come into play. However, even if the researcher was able to filter out all of these extraneous variables, because this is a relatively simple experiment, it does not tell us a great deal about human beings. In other words, even if you could do an experiment like this and do it accurately work through the various variables, it doesn't tell us a whole lot. If the researcher seeks to delve into the more profound issues, such as the relationship of marital happiness to anger, the difficulties increase exponentially. Among the challenges, there is the question of cause and effect. For example, in comparing anger and marital happiness, it would be difficult to determine whether it was the anger that disrupted the marital happiness, or the lack of marital happiness that created the anger, or whether each was influencing the other to some degree, whether we had a cybernetic here where each was impacting the other, a feedback circuit, if you will. the latter would probably be the case. In other words, there would probably be some interplay between them. And that would make understanding of the relationship between the two all the more complex and lead to the question of what level of influence each was having on the other. How much was anger influencing the marriage and marriage influencing anger and so forth. The point in all this is that dealing with human beings, there seems to be no end to the complexities, and the more comprehensive the objective of a study, the more complex it becomes. Therefore, being scientific about simple issues is difficult, and dealing scientifically with overarching psychological topics is virtually impossible. Another challenge, in addition to the multiplicity of variables that confronts the psychologist, is found in the realms to which science does not have access, such as the soul. In other words, science can study the superficial things about human beings, but we believe that the person has a soul, and how can he get in there and study the soul or even other aspects of the human personality that are buried deep within him. For example, in studying the relationship between marital happiness and anger, we must consider that human beings are not biological machines that produce a given response to a stimulus. Therefore, even if the experimenter was able to control all other variables, which in reality he can't, one individual may have a terrible marriage and display high levels of hostility as a result, while another person may believe that such an attitude is morally wrong and choose to respond differently. In other words, the marriage might be just as terrible, but he might resolve on moral grounds to be nice to his spouse instead of being angry. And even on a more profound level, one person may be a believer who, under the influence of the Holy Spirit, displays love even in the midst of a bad marriage. And so science can't look into the soul of a person, the heart of a person, and see these variables and take them into account. Behaviorism, one theoretical approach to psychology that we will describe later, has attempted to solve this problem of the soul, of the inner workings of the individual, by pronouncing that the soul does not exist. As a result, the research scientist can view the human being just as he would a biological machine. The problem with this approach, of course, is that wishing the soul out of existence for the purpose of scientific experimentation does not make it go away. Hence, experiments that do not account for the soul are faulty because they begin with an erroneous view of human beings. You just can't wish the soul away so that you can do scientific experiments. This is not to say that psychologists cannot do some experiments effectively. With issues related to the superficial aspects of the human being, they can do quite well. However, as they seek to penetrate the depths of the human personality, dealing with issues more directly related to the soul, they find themselves in water that is well over their heads. Yet another hurdle confronting psychologists in doing research is human bias. As human beings, we are biased about virtually everything. However, this bias is especially acute in the area of psychology because the issues involved in psychology become very personal. For example, if the psychologist concludes that the human being is responsible for his actions, he is calling himself to responsibility. And perhaps he is even pronouncing self-condemnation because he hasn't met that responsibility. The level of bias is heightened even more by the strong anti-God, pro-humanistic orientation on the university campus, which is the site of a great deal of psychological research. The same bias represents a predominant orientation of the psychological community in general. In other words, most psychologists are humanistic in their orientation. Many examples could be cited demonstrating the negative impact of this humanistic bias on psychological research. Let me just mention one. A study recently done on the impact of self-esteem on violence discovered that previous studies on the subject included the unsupported assumption that those guilty of inappropriate behavior must have low self-esteem, even though they display arrogance.